Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Councilmember District A, Joe Geruso, the New Orleans City Council. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, Noel.
So, Joe, you participated yesterday in the Criminal Justice Committee meeting. You guys were able to talk to Chief Kirkpatrick as well as Sheriff Susan Hudson about this most recent jailbreak, kind of the breakdown in the notification process, and a lot of discussion about budgeting. Your thoughts about the committee meeting yesterday?
Well, two walkaways from our perspective. I think, number one, I was a little surprised the sheriff came in and apologized at the start of the meeting and accepted responsibility for what happened. And I think when people tend to do that, that tends to take a lot of the wind out of people's sails, although it did get heated at a couple of other points. I think there are a couple things. One, you've mentioned the communication issue. I think we're still very much looking at the timeline here, but as we learned yesterday, first meal in the jail is around 5:15 or 5:30. Allegedly, there's no headcount at that point. There is headcount beginning around, I think, 6:30. That's supposed to take an hour. That apparently took longer here, I guess, because they were looking to see who was missing. And then there's a time lag between 8:30 and I think closer to 10:30 when NOPD affirmatively knew what happened. So, again, I'm not saying this to beat up on the sheriff right now at this point. I think the idea is for going forward, the earlier things are communicated, and I know, Noel, we've talked many times about dispatching police and in a matter of seconds or just a couple of minutes is so much more important than 10-minute lead time. Same thing obviously true with escapees. And then the last point is maybe in the weeds for others, but I think for the council it's been really important, which is the sheriff takes a position that I'm the elected official and I control what happens with the money and it's your obligation, city, to fund it to us. And I think the city, and that's both the mayor and the council in this one, take the position that may be what the law says by the letter, but if you want the money, we should have some insight into what's going on and how much is needed. And so the sheriff reported a $13 million need yesterday. I know the federal judges are looking at that right now. I think everybody's trying to decide what really critically needs to happen in a jail. If there are things that immediately need to be fixed, like locks or alarms or some video, and then what are the other things that probably need to happen too, Newell, both in the way of the sheriff looking at bonding capacity, which they didn't have an answer for yesterday, and then also looking at the jail population. If you have Department of Correction prisoners, DOC prisoners, and those shouldn't be in jail, then we need to get them into prison. If there are people with more minor violations, you need to get them out. And you've run a jail, so you know. It's not to our advantage to unnecessarily hold people who don't need to be there. And we do have a lock of 1250, and we've been at 1450. And, you know, just a couple of years ago, we were closer to about 990. So it can be done. We just have to proactively manage. And that means all the other people, as the governor said, have to push through and make sure the cases are moving the way that they should. So I know that's a lot, but it's pretty much everybody needs to be moving forward, doing their jobs, making sure things are funded, making sure there's a requisite communication as well.
Joe, you made an observation yesterday, and I thought you were spot on. I mean, yeah, yesterday, and you were spot on saying that this is a friction point that has existed for a long time. I actually worked for the Orleans Parish Criminal Sheriff's Office back in 1977 through 1980. It was an issue then, and it's the same issue today. This single reporting entity of an independently elected official versus whether or not you are going to be treated as an agency under the construct of the city of New Orleans. Yesterday, there seemed to be testimony from both Sheriff Hudson as well as the CFO that they'd like to be both. But that's not really a reality. Although it looks like they might have left a crack in the door to accomplish what you just outlined as being one of the friction points that are difficult for the city administration.
Yeah, I think they've made that point. And look, Newell, I mean, I mentioned it yesterday, and my mom has told me about it, and I sort of vaguely remember my grandfather and the previous sheriff used to argue with each other because they would come with a sheet of paper and say, these are the needs. And of course, when you're the appropriating body, you say, thank you, but we need more detail. I think where the council and I think even the administration would get more comfortable is if the sheriff and other officials who were giving a fair amount of money to got on the city's accounting system so we can actually see what's going on. And I just give you one example. The administration takes the position that the sheriff has $14 million in unrestricted fund balance because that's what their audit shows. The sheriff says that's not true because I have other obligations and there's really just a fraction of that left. Well, that shouldn't be an issue that partners are fighting about. That should be something that's knowable to each side. And I kind of think, Newell, I don't know what you think about it, but my view is having comfort in money and spending also leads to better communications and people not being entrenched in their positions of you don't need this, you do need this. When you get to have a look underneath the hood, then it's a lot easier for people to have a view into what is necessary, what is a luxury, and what is a maybe longer term want.
Yeah, I mean, look, I made in my monologue today, I said I really believe that there are two parallel paths that need to be taken. One is an operational audit, which very much would influence the financials, right? It's easy to say I need X, Y, and Z on the financial side, and then you ask the question for what and what's the return on our investment and where is this being spent and how is it going to be spent? And then, you know, you hear noise, you know, so there's an appropriate way to staff the facility based upon the construct of the facility. And there are experts in that field that can give you the exact number of people that you need, taken into account leave, sick leave, you know, holidays and all of that. And you can figure out a number and you can come to an agreement on what that is ultimately going to be. You know, the city, for the longest time, as you well know, y'all funded a per diem. It was real easy from a budgeting perspective. You know, we agree that we're going to fund 1,200 inmates. We're going to give you so much money per day. You go figure out how you're going to spend it, but don't come back and ask us for any more money. And, you know, and then you carved out medical because it used to be medical was included in that per diem number. So y'all are coming off multiple iterations of financing this facility, and I don't know that y'all have ever come to rest in a place that's or a landscape that's very comfortable to either your side or the other side. And maybe this is the moment in time where that can ultimately happen, right? But I do believe that nothing will be fruitful without an operational audit.
I think that's all correct. And look, I guess two things. One is, and I've said this to the media before, I've said it to you, when there were complaints about was the budgeting appropriate, were things working, there has been something operational because the federal monitors have been in this building on a regular basis. And so as I told the press as they were circling around all of this, if the federal monitors were raising real, true alarms, the judges would not hesitate to tell the city and the council, this is what you have to appropriate. I mean, it's happened with salaries. It's happened with the medical facility. So there's no doubt about that. You're right. I guess what I kind of don't like about this, just as a philosophy, is I don't love the idea that this has to occur as a result of something tragic and bad happening in order to have this conversation. But sometimes you need an inflection point to have it. And I know the city reached out yesterday to the sheriff to begin these discussions about getting in the system. And look, as I was trying to say in my questions yesterday about whether or not the sheriff can bond out and have money that's independent of the city, getting fewer prisoners into the jail. The whole idea here is trying to create economies of scales that make things easier for the sheriff, whoever that may be, to do their job, and so that there's a good line of sight, and we're not micromanaging the sheriff on the day-to-day, but at the same time, when the council, the city's appropriating close to $65 million, $70 million, it's also hard to say, here's a blank check, and we're not going to worry about it anymore. It's in good hands. So those two things are in conflict, and now trying to reconcile them, I think, is really important.
Joe, I think one of the issues, and you mentioned it, you know, y'all had appropriate or set a number of 1,200 of what y'all are willing to appropriate dollars for. We're at 14-something. This was an issue, obviously, in the election of Susan Hudson when she first got elected. And I bring it up all the time. She said that we should be able to manage the criminal population of the city of New Orleans with 500 beds. Well, there weren't many people that bought into that. I didn't buy into it because I knew the rate of arrest of the NOPD, and I knew the severity of the culture of these arrested individuals. That they, you know, these were serious felons, and you wanted to selectively incapacitate them. You didn't want them rolling in and rolling out. And that there was no way that it was going to be 500. And here we are at 14-something. And I've looked at the complexion of the prisoner base there from serious felony violations. These are bad people, really bad people. I mean, we're not, you don't have misdemeanors, you know, consuming portions of this jail. You have probation violators, you have a bunch of other things that you have to deal with, but I'm not sure that we are. I'm asking you, are you confident that y'all have reached a point where you know what the number should be based on the crime in this city?
Yeah, it's something we're looking at right now. So the DOC prisoners, and again, this is Department of Correction prisoners, are the numbers I most closely monitor. And I think as of yesterday, there were maybe around 75 or 80 in the jail. And again, those are people who should not be there. And then I was told as of yesterday, and you just raised it, that of probation folks on violation, there were about 100 of those. So assuming those numbers are right, and again, depending on the severity of the probation violation, what the crime is, I mean, that's 175 people almost off the top who maybe can be removed from the jail for a variety of different reasons. But I've taken the same approach you have, Newell, which is if you're in jail for, you know, a murder, rape, armed robbery, serious felony charges, then we're just not going to release you. That can't be what needs to happen. And then you just go down the list from there and see where you are. And very much with the people who are DOC and other smaller things, we whittle it down. So I'm at a point of, I don't know that we'll get back to pick a number, 750 or 800, but I do think through being vigilant and trying to make sure the cases are working through the court, you can get a lot closer to the 1250 number too.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, it's just a question of how much risk you want to assume, quite frankly. You know, I mean, it's something that we had to manage at the JPSO for a long, long time because we've been in the same boat. We've been in overcrowded conditions like forever. You know, when you're making 60, 70, 80, 90 felony arrests a day, it doesn't take long to fill the jail up. And I don't know what I would assume that NOPD is probably arresting numbers somewhere close to that.
Yeah, look, I think that's always the heartburn. I mean, it's almost like any situation where at the end, the decisions are pretty easy. Somebody who clearly belongs in jail on a murder charge, somebody who's picked up for shoplifting only at a very minor level doesn't. And then as you get closer to the middle, that's where the decisions get harder. And again, I think we were at 990 a long time ago, and this was before the crime wave happened in, I guess, 22. So, I think it requires looking at everything. And again, if we're talking about the sheriff, I think we need to talk about not only the prisoners who need to be moved out because they belong at the state prisons as opposed to the jail, but also is what Governor Landry said over the weekend needing review. Are there cases that have been languishing for too long? Are there things that need to be moving faster? And I think those are fair questions, too, about whether or not those folks, you know, need to go to trial and then they cycle through and they belong either out of jail or in prison, depending on what their sentence is.
You've probably heard me talk about throughput into the court system, and it's all about that throughput. And without that, you exacerbate every challenge that you have in that jail. Everyone. You push it to the max every day, 24/7, if you don't have throughput through that system and handling these cases and getting them resolved and moving them out. And, you know, we used to on the state's back every day trying to get them to take our people that we had the paperwork, the commitment papers, everything ready to move to DOC because we needed capacity. You know, there are other people I wanted to hold. It's not fun when you are releasing an armed robber, right? And that's the best option that you have. You know, and it's like, this is crazy. You know, I've got this person sentenced, ready to go. We need to get them out. We need to get them over there. If I got to bring them, I'll bring them. I don't care. But I don't want to leak. I don't want to let this armed robber out of the door. Right. But unfortunately, these are the unpleasant truths of what's going on in these systems across the country. This is not unique to the city of New Orleans.
It is not. Managing different systems because you have the DA, you have judges, you have the jailer, you have NOPD. And so when you have, and I've said this so many times, and you have different agencies and certainly elected officials touching something, it's just easier for the finger pointing to happen or for people to blame somebody else. And the harder thing to do is to get all on the same page and say, look, these are the priorities that we're going to make. This is the way that we're going to handle things. And look, also, and this is the other side of it too, Noel, if something goes the wrong way because of a policy decision that was made, then also making sure everybody's standing shoulder to shoulder, say, we did this with eyes wide open. This is our rationale. This is what happened. And, you know, sometimes that happens as well. So it's all of those things that have to happen. And again, this break is much more than just the 10 people who got out and the 5 who remain, which is the immediate focus. But I think the longer term one, particularly with elections coming up, is what's going on to improve the throughput, the communication, and having a good established policy about, you know, how many people are in the jail and how all of that's handled.
Yeah. Joe, a lot of independent investigations going on. How do you herd all of this together for the purposes of the council? Is there an intention to have them make presentations to the Criminal Justice Committee or the council at large in its totality?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I was kicking myself a little bit because of the meeting on Tuesday, not calling the sheriff in advance, because there are obvious things that they know right now that they're not sharing publicly. I know that the AG is conducting the investigation. The federal monitors happen to be in town. I would think the things that would be the most helpful to me are, how do you line up the federal monitors have to say with the investigation, with the AG, and then what are the things that we learn from the sheriff? Like, for example, yesterday, the sheriff said for the first time that the protocols for monitoring were broken. Well, okay, we all know that, right? Like, something happened at 12:30 or 1 o'clock in the morning, and that nobody's notified till 8:30 is a problem. But my view is probably by having three or four different data sets and then kind of overlaying all of those is where you get the best information. And I think a lot of that will also happen with the federal judge, Newell, because they had the status conference on Monday. They're going to have another conference in another few weeks. And I kind of feel like having that third party arbiter looking at everything will help us the whole deal rather than politicizing this between New Orleans, Baton Rouge, and everything else too. So that's kind of my goal, is to see how all those things line up and then see what the federal courts have to say as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I know this will five out. I mean, five backs, five still out. You know, we need to thank the first responders, the law enforcement community, all of the agencies participating in this. I think there's north of 200 officers that are out there looking for the remaining five, and we wish them the best of luck. And I know you feel the same way.
Absolutely. And we said it yesterday, but I don't think it can be repeated enough, that we know the first responders are doing their level best and are in really good, tight quarters right now, coordinating and helping each other work through this. And I don't think the city will rest till the remaining five prisoners are captured.
No doubt. Thank you so much for joining us, Joe. We know that you are incredibly busy. We appreciate your time, your insight. Best of luck.
Thanks, Neil. Take care.
That's Joe Geruso, New Orleans City Council Member, District A. We will be right back, and when we return, we'll visit with Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. We'll talk about the Russia-Ukraine ceasefire. It was on, but maybe not. We shall see. We'll be right back. Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, to talk about the Russia-Ukraine negotiation. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Newell, always a pleasure.
Colonel, I don't even know how to characterize this, but I guess the easiest way is to just say that President Trump seems to have backstroked off of what he had said before, that he was going to be able to reach some successful conclusion to this negotiation. But now he's out, and he says that Vladimir Putin is going to negotiate directly with the president of Ukraine, Zelensky. Your thoughts?
Well, you characterize it rather well, Newell. I mean, don't forget, Donald Trump ran for the presidency of the United States on a campaign saying that I can end this war in one day, and I may even end it before I enter the White House. Well, he's now been in the White House for, by my calculation, about 120 days, and we're no closer to ending this conflict than we were the day before he was elected. And as you say quite rightfully, I think, but now the president's saying, well, I'm just going to take my marble bag and go home. I'm done with this, and just walk away. Which kind of, to me, suggests broader questions, which is, we see ourselves as a major power and a leader of the the free world, if not the world as a whole. Seems to me we're kind of abrogating, at least in this case, those responsibilities. Second of all, of course, this has an awful lot to do with the unity of the NATO alliance and the Biden administration. You can criticize them for it, and that would be fine. I think tried to pull NATO together in the aftermath of the Russian invasion and saw this as a point of unity, and even admitted two new members, Finland and Sweden, since this war has begun. And so now it seems to me, to a large degree, we're at least walking away from that commitment to NATO, if not walking away from our NATO commitments more broadly.
So what is the rub here? I mean, is it just attention deficit disorder, or I don't understand. I mean, you know, I know what the Russians are trying to do. They've done their manner of negotiation. I mean, if I can figure it out, I know you know well, you know, all the years you've been around this, what they do, they'll just drag this on. They'll get a concession here, a concession there, and then it'll go on forever.
Yeah, the Russians are great, and historically, not just Mr. Putin the last 25 years, about what I used to say. They're great at creating a problem and telling you that you got to solve the problem they created, which is exactly what we have going on here. And I think what Mr. Trump may have not fully understood is, from the very onset, Putin wanted victory, and Mr. Trump wanted a ceasefire. So they were moving in different directions from the very onset. And as a consequence, Putin determined that he always thought, and still does, to my mind, has the willpower to do this for as long as it takes to achieve that victory he wants so desperately. And eventually he thought Mr. Trump would either lose interest or lose willpower. And so far, at least, he has turned out to be correct. On Mr. Trump's side, I think he has had, and I kind of can't understand it, Neil, this sort of, for lack of a better phrase, misguided belief that somehow he and Putin had this relationship as strong people, as major powers, that he likes Putin. He's never ever really criticized Putin any time, first term, this term, really. Don't forget, back in 2018, he met Putin in Helsinki and came out in a press conference and immediately repudiated all seven of the U.S. intelligence services because Mr. Trump said, well, Putin told me he didn't interfere in our elections, and I believe Putin, basically saying, I don't believe our intelligence service, I believe him. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, Mr. Trump has had this belief, I think, since he came into office this time, that there was this golden opportunity to establish great relations with Russians, and that would reap enormous economic bonanzas. And I'm sure Putin stoked that belief in the conversation they've had, because even in this case, Mr. Trump talked about the enormous economic opportunities that Russia could have with the United States if we could kind of get this war out of the way. And again, I never quite understood that, because to me, Russia is a declining power of about 140 million people whose economy is smaller than Italy's. And it's going in the opposite direction as the population ages. So how that was going to be a great economic engine for us while we, if you will, estrange our European allies who have about 400 million people and a GDP in total that's not too far distant from ours. So those are the drivers. And now, like I say, Mr. Trump says, I'm just going to walk away and you guys figure it out.
So this leaves Ukraine. I mean, can we honestly say that this is going to be a negotiation? I mean, from my perspective, I don't think it's going to be a negotiation. I think it's going to be a sit down, and there's going to be dictates that are going to be issued. And what does Zelensky do?
Well, the first thing, I'm fairly convinced, and I've talked to a lot of Ukrainians that I've known over the years, is they won't quit. Okay. I mean, I got to tell you, my read of the Ukrainians, if it came down to fighting with rocks, well, they might well do that. So Mr. Putin may think he's going to be successful in conquering this particular country, and who knows, he might well be. But I think the costs, even now, which are enormous, are going to be unbelievably enormous to do that, number one, and then maintain control of that population in the aftermath. I wish you all the luck, Mr. Putin, I guess. So they will not capitulate. They just won't. Okay, number one. Number two, of course, the question is, what do our European allies do? And our European allies, most notably, we had the Prime Minister of Poland, we had the Prime Minister of Great Britain, the Chancellor of Germany, the President of France, all went to Kyiv on the 9th of May, anniversary of the end of World War II, to publicly pledge their solidarity with the Ukrainians. And subsequently, we've seen announcements about additional arms going from European countries to the Ukrainians. So the Europeans are going to try to see if they can, if you will, pick up the slack in terms of military assistance to the Ukrainians. The Ukrainians also have their own indigenous defense industries, and they may still, it looks like Mr. Trump's willing to. He did a small sale or approved a small sale of F-16 parts to the Ukrainians a couple weeks ago, may be willing to sell, I emphasize sell and not military aid, military equipment to Ukraine. In fact, the basis of this mineral deal that was signed up between Ukraine and the United States was that future provision of military assistance to Ukraine would be considered part of that overall investment. Whether that can be affected or not remains to be seen, because obviously no one's going to expand mining in Ukraine while this war is going on. But Mr. Putin believes he can be successful, and at the moment he's expending somewhere around 1,000 to 1,500 casualties every day. The Russians, for every square kilometer they capture, they suffer about 100 casualties. He is able so far, Putin, to recruit manpower to replace those people. Not much over that. He's kind of just recruiting enough to make up for his losses. And whether or not he can continue to do that and eventually grind the Ukrainians down remains to be seen.
So in light of everything that you just said, obviously this doesn't end anytime soon, and it really then becomes the wherewithal of the NATO alliance and how far down the road they're willing to go.
Yeah, exactly. As, I mean,
you know, and what happens to the relationship between them and the U.S.? I mean, know the bright line that Trump is going to draw, right?
Yeah, this to me is the ultimate question, because I firmly believe, and I've been only doing this stuff for about 50 years, that the objective of every Russian Soviet leader since 1949, their ultimate objective was always the same, destroy NATO. There may have been other things that we were doing, but those were means to that particular end. I think one reason why Mr. Putin wants to persevere in Ukraine is this whole issue of Ukraine now has become a wedge between the United States and the European allies. And the more he can press that particular point, I think moves him in that direction. Example, we're going to have a NATO summit at the very end of June, which ought to be an interesting event, to say the very least. The United States has already opposed an invitation that was going to be extended by the European allies to Mr. Zelensky to attend the NATO summit. Well, the Trump administration is blocking that particular invitation being extended to Zelensky. Furthermore, the United States already in advance of that summit has urged consideration about recreating something called the NATO-Russia Council, which was a bilateral meeting between Russia and the NATO members that had existed at Brussels pre-invasion of Ukraine as a place for dialogue between NATO and Russia. It was disbanded after the invasion, and Trump's calling for that to be resurrected. So it'll be a real question on how this affects the NATO alliance. And then last but not least, as far as negotiations go, Mr. Putin says, oh, he'll negotiate, and the bilateral negotiations Trump has called for, but he wants to negotiate under what they call in Russia the Istanbul Protocol, which is their outline. And their outline goes like this. When Ukraine announces that it will never try to join NATO, when Ukraine announces that they're going to get rid of the Zelensky government and bring in a new government, when Ukraine announces that it will be neutral forever, not join any organization, when Ukraine reduces its army to 80,000 soldiers from about 1 million right now, when Ukraine agrees to accept Russian as an official language of Ukraine and change a bunch of names of cities back to their Russian names, when you do all those things, then we'll negotiate. But those are all preconditions to from the Russian side for a bilateral negotiation to end the war to begin. That sounds like surrender to me, and I just don't think the Ukrainians will do that.
Well, the only powerful tool that we really have is going to be U.S. sanctions on Russia, right? And without if you're removing that from the template, this is all for naught.
Well, that could be the wild card in the deck. I mean, we have two. One is military aid, and obviously it doesn't appear we're going to do much of that. And the second, you're right, is sanctions. Now, Mr. Trump has repeatedly threatened if Putin's, as he says, if he's just tapping me, then he has threatened sanctions. But he's never delivered on those things, and it doesn't look like he's going to deliver now. The Europeans have announced a 17th round of sanctions, particularly going after the so-called Russian shadow fleet, which is a means by which they bypass sanctions on oil to sell oil on world markets. Now, in the Senate, there's a bipartisan law being passed or been proposed to put much more significant sanctions on the Russians. So, again, it'll be interesting to watch if, in fact, that, and I emphasize bipartisan, I mean people like Lindsey Graham from South Carolina support this. If that passes the Senate, then what does the Trump administration do? Do they veto that? Or do they simply say, well, you know, the Senate, they're not part of, they're out of control, you know, and let that move along. And so sanctions, so-called secondary sanctions, will be very significant. But I think one thing that surprises me, this whole conversation, is the United States has already made significant concessions to the Russians since Mr. Trump became president, not going to be part of NATO. Ukraine has to give up territory. Mr. Trump publicly said he would accept de jure. I mean, public recognition that Crimea is officially part of the Russian Federation.
Yeah.
No other country in Europe would do that. Okay. His Secretary of State passed a resolution in the Senate when he was still there, forbidding any government in the United States to do just that. Entered these negotiations, urged Mr. Putin to show up for discussions with Zelensky for a ceasefire. Putin didn't show up. Convinced Zelensky or forced Zelensky to publicly say he would accept a 30-day ceasefire. Mr. Putin rebuffed that. So we've already made a whole series of concessions and gotten nothing out of it. And now we've made the ultimate concession. We quit.
Yeah, I mean, if you would just, we have just about a minute or two left, but how important is signaling as it relates to this, you know, these diplomatic challenges that we have? Because it seems as though this president doesn't concern himself with that at all. I mean, and it's all over the map. There's no consistency. It doesn't seem to be a strategic plan here that dots are being connected and we understand where we're actually going. We're all over the place.
Yeah, and it changes every minute. I mean, even the last couple of months, go to the disastrous meeting in February between Zelensky and Trump. And of course, relations between the two countries were at their absolute nadir. Then that seemed to come back and Mr. Trump moved to being a bit more balanced. And we had the mineral deal with Ukraine. We had the meeting between Trump and Zelensky at the funeral for the Pope. And then we're moving to this. Well, I'm going to walk away. So you're all over the place. And the signaling, as you suggest, is very important. Seems to me as Americans, there are three reasons I always say that we think we should be involved in the war in Ukraine. First is a matter of morality. Okay, I've fought in the Gulf War and commanded the battalion. We didn't go to the Gulf War and liberate Kuwait because we wanted to make it the 51st state. We did it because the Iraqis invaded a small country called Kuwait, which was independent and sovereign, and killed an awful lot of people and basically persecuted the population. Kind of like what the Russians are doing right now. Yeah. I saw a film just yesterday.
Sounds
Russian soldiers executing. But yeah, exactly. Executing Ukrainian soldiers who had surrendered. So a matter of morality. A second, a matter of values. We say we're on the side of democratic states and states that pursue individual liberty. Well, Ukraine is far from a perfect democracy. Neither are we, by the way. But they're a hell of a lot more a democracy than the Russian Federation ever is or ever was. And then last but not least, or ever will be, geopolitics. I mean, I always quote the Japanese prime minister who came to Kyiv a year or so ago, stood in the streets of Kyiv with Zelensky and said, if you want to deter the Chinese from aggression in the Indo-Pacific, meaning Taiwan, you have to stand up and win this war here. And I guarantee you the Chinese are watching this and saying, well, if the Americans aren't going to defend Ukraine, why in the world would they defend Taiwan?
Yeah. Yeah, this is, I don't know, I get this feeling that we're running amok right now, and it's not a good feeling. It's something that is mystifying to me, to say the least, and we'll continue to monitor this, and thank you so much for joining us and adding context to all of this, because there are a lot of different things that people don't realize that are going on, that are actually going on, and I kind of love the way that you just take it straight on and point out these unpleasant truths that we're facing and we're not dealing with on a daily basis, and it's going to be interesting to see where this ends. As always, thank you so much for joining us.
Sometimes truth is inconvenient.
Oh, yeah. More often than not. Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Thank you so much, sir. Have a great week. We'll be right back. Stay with us. So that was interesting conversation, and we'll continue to call upon Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, for updates relative to this issue. Seems to be a bunch of talking points that folks are referencing about our approach here. Kind of crazy. We're all over the map. I just don't understand which way we're going here. It seems as though the Trump administration is frustrated. They're not getting what they desire. I think a lot of folks look at it this way, and they're willing to walk away. No one ever believed really that we were going to resolve this in a day, and no one ever believed, I didn't anyway, that this would be resolved before he actually takes office. It's, you know, it was nice to have these aspirational goals, but the reality kind of slaps you in the face oftentimes. And I think right now we're being slapped in the face because the reality is that Vladimir Putin is not willing to do much of anything that we propose gets done. They have their strategy intact. They know exactly where they desire to go. The question is, do we know where we're headed? We'll be right back. Check in with Scoot when we return. Stay with us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
Well, we'll talk about some politics. We'll also talk about the fringe folks who are trying to target Doppler radar because they're weapons.
All righty. Scoot's headed your way, folks. Stay tuned. See you again in the morning.